I'm very pleased to welcome as my next guest the 46th Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney. His public service also includes time as Chief of Staff for President Ford, Congressman for the state of Wyoming, and Defense Secretary for the first President Bush. Along with his daughter Liz, Mr. Cheney is also the author of the new book, In My Time, A Personal and Political Memoir. And Mr. Vice President, thank you very much for your time today.
Well, it's good to be on the show.
Let's start with the war on terror. You write that the weekend following 9/11 that you and Condi Rice and a couple of other high-ranking administration officials were up at Camp David for a series of meetings that weekend, and obviously still trying to wrap your minds around entirely what had happened and how different the world would be and already was. What were the first things in your mind immediately that needed to be decided moving forward about how U.S. policy would change?
The big change that occurred with 9/11 was prior to that time we had really, I think as a government, not just our administration, but the approach of the federal government to terrorist acts was to treat them as primarily a law enforcement problem. You'd go out and find the bad guy, arrest him, bring him to trial, and put him in prison. 9/11 changed all that because that morning we lost nearly 3,000 people, more than we lost at Pearl Harbor. And that clearly was an act of war. That wasn't just a law enforcement problem. And what it meant was that somebody out there who was organized enough to bring considerable harm to the United States, striking both the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and determined, obviously, to use any means at their disposal to get at us if they could. And we had to respond accordingly. That is, we had to treat it as though we were at war, marshal not only our law enforcement assets, but our intelligence capabilities, our military capabilities, and so forth. That was probably the biggest change, and a whole bunch of policy decisions then flowed from that.
You point out in the book that while Afghanistan was obviously the focal point at that point, given where al-Qaeda was based and the Taliban that was harboring them, there was some discussion of Iraq. And I imagine your critics would say, aha, well, Iraq was already on the agenda. But explain what the context was of that part of the Iraq conversation at that time.
Sure. Well, you've got to remember there's this notion out there that somehow the president and I sat down one morning and began to focus on Iraq. That started long before we even got elected. If you go back to 1998, Bill Clinton gave a speech then that sounded like me in the summer of 2002, talking about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction and the likelihood that he would use them in a future crisis. Congress passed legislation signed by the president calling for a change of regimes in Iraq. They appropriated $100 million to support the political opposition, to support the notion of changing regimes in Iraq. And then you had a whole series of reports through 98, 99, on into 2000 of involvement on the one hand of the Iraqi government with sponsoring terror, paying suicide bombers, families, and so forth, but also working on weapons of mass destruction. I think it was 98 they kicked out all the UN weapons inspectors. So the notion that there was a potential problem in Iraq started long before we ever arrived in the White House.
On the issue of weapons of mass destruction, you point out in the book that the chief weapons inspector, after the war had begun, that had gone in there to evaluate what exactly Saddam had been up to, David Kay, reported that while he didn't find any stockpiles of weapons, he did find evidence that there had been an active program, certainly in chemical weapons, harder to find a footprint for biological weapons. Yet eventually, because the stockpiles weren't found, the official position became that the intelligence just wasn't right. What do you believe today? Was the intelligence really wrong? Do you think the weapons were moved? What do you personally believe in your gut?
Well, it's not all black or white. I mean, it's, you know, as oftentimes in these kinds of situations, especially when you're dealing with intelligence on a government that doesn't want to have people know what they're up to, where you get a mix. What we had was no stockpiles, so the intelligence was wrong on that piece of it. But he did have the technical capability to produce. He had the personnel who had produced it previously. He had previously produced it and used it. He had every intention, based on what our people found when they went in there, that indeed he planned to go back to producing WMD when everybody else turned away and the sanctions were lifted and so forth. So I pretty well came out where David Kay did. That is, that he was a dangerous individual. He had nasty capabilities, and he had previously used them not only on the Iranians but also on his own people. And while we didn't find stockpiles of weapons, that he did, in fact, constitute a significant risk.
Another issue, of course, that arose at the time of the intelligence debate was the Valerie Plame controversy. As you write, not only did Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage give Valerie Plame's name to Bob Novak, but the special prosecutor actually knew that pretty much from the get-go of the investigation. Did you ever get an explanation from Armitage or Patrick Fitzgerald about why the probe continued when pretty much all the questions had been answered?
Never did. And I don't know that I ever will. We ended up with a two-plus-year investigation with a lot of people being dragged before the grand jury, supposedly in the search to find out who had leaked her name to the press. And, of course, the fact was before Fitzgerald ever got in business, which was the end of 2003, the Justice Department already knew, and he was told, had to know at the outset of his investigation, that, in fact, the guilty party was Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State. But Scooter Libby is the one who ended up obviously indicted and tried, and I think unjustly so. Nothing was ever done where Armitage was concerned. Nobody was ever charged with the leak. It was one of those investigations, once it gets started, and we've seen this in other cases, they won't stop until they find somebody they can indict.
You also write in the book, sir, that you were disappointed in the actions of then-Secretary of State Colin Powell, who knew that Armitage had told Patrick Fitzgerald the truth. And you also, on a larger scale, say that while you recommended Powell to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs back when you were defense secretary, and he did a great job in that role, that as Secretary of State, whether it was the Valerie Plame issue or in some ways giving very different versions of his views on Iraq in cabinet meetings versus public appearances, that they weren't real consistent. What do you think is responsible for the change there?
Well, I don't know. I wanted to put down the a few key areas there where obviously there were problems. I tried to be balanced, and I didn't want to take it to any kind of personal attack. And as I say, I tried to be supportive of General Powell. I was pleased to support him and recommend his selection as chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And I thought we worked well together through Desert Storm and our time together in the Pentagon. It just turned out later on when he was at State and I was the vice president that the relationship soured considerably.
Another figure that you expressed a little bit of disappointment in was CIA Director George Tenet for resigning in 2004 after the administration had gone to great lengths to defend him despite a few hits and misses along the way. Why was there still so much confidence in Tenet despite a mixed record? Is that just a function of the intelligence game or something else?
Well, it's a tough job. I mean, no question about being a director of the CIA, especially under those circumstances. You know, it's the kind of business where you don't hit 1,000. They do their best, and there's some fantastic people involved in the intelligence business. The thing I was somewhat frustrated about with respect to Director Tenet was he worked in the previous administration, the president, in effect stuck his neck out to keep him on in our administration, even though he had been the Democratic staff director for the Intel Committee in the Senate, for example. And defended the choice, and we worked with him and defended him through the fact, for example, that they missed the indicators on 9/11, and then in the middle of the campaign, in I guess it was 04, George just suddenly came down one day and decided to quit and left. And I always felt he left the president high and dry, and instead of being out there fighting the good fight, so to speak, that he packed it in and took off. And I didn't think that was necessarily a very good way for him to treat the administration that had made it possible for him to continue that job.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney, who also served this nation as Secretary of Defense, Chief of Staff to President Ford, as well as, for more than a decade, a U.S. Congressman from the state of Wyoming. His book is In My Time, co-authored with his daughter Liz. Please look for the second half of our conversation as we talk about the 2000 election campaign and some of the critical domestic policy decisions made by the Bush-Cheney administration. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.